The Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
You're listening to the Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio. This evening we are playing you the full live version of Blackshaw's first ever Scare Slam that was held on the 25th of November. You're about to listen to six very spooky tales written by six fantastic writers, emceed by the wonderful Duncan Gates.
Welcome to the inaugural Blackshaw Scare Slam. Oh, you're good, thank you. This is the first of hopefully many such events. The ambition of this evening essentially being we have a good half dozen. I keep miscounting on my list, but we have at least half dozen people who are going to be telling scary stories tonight for your listening pleasure. Anyway, that's probably enough for me. It's probably about time for you, your first fabulous act this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, Liam Logan!
Hello. This story is called Anna. It's weird, the things that can mess up a kid's head. Take Anna, for example. She was convinced that every time she looked under her bed, the universe split in two. In a parallel world in which a mirror Anna also looked under her bed before going to sleep and after saying her prayers, and where, up until then, she'd never found anything bad, this time there would be a ghastly demon with wicked teeth and blood-stained claws whose only desire was to catch and tear apart Anna, aged 6¾ years. Little wonder she said her prayers before she looked. Little wonder she had nightmares. I told her that wasn't the way the multiverse theory worked. That for every Anna that found a slavering beast, there was one that found a toy she'd lost, or one that forgot to look under the bed. She skewered me with her most outraged look. This Anna never forgot. But it's hard arguing theoretical physics with a child yet to turn 7. And as I wasn't prepared to deny the theory outright, it was clear this notion was not going to be an easy one to shift. It wasn't simply that she had a binary yes versus no, either or view, the coin toss that happened in her imagination every time she lifted the skirt that kept the under the bed out of sight. It was because what terrified her wasn't the finding a monster under the bed. It was the not finding a monster under the bed. In her head, every time she survived, she doomed the parallel universe Anna to a grisly death. It was the guilt that was crushing her. "Why don't you not look?" I reasoned. "I have to," she replied with an air of ancient sorrow. "There might be a monster under the bed. I have to check. And even if I don't, the other Anna will." This had me scratching my head, figuratively speaking. I'm a psychiatrist by trade, not a physicist. Wouldn't that require the universe to have already split? And once the other Anna looked, it would be her universe that split again, not this Anna's. Maybe this was something I could use. "Anna," I said, "who looks first, you or the other Anna?" She suspected a trick and trod carefully. "We both..." And then she corrected herself. "There is no other Anna. Not until I look. Or there is... But it's me, and we haven't split yet." "If she is you, will she react to finding the monster the same way you would?" She sucked air through the gap in her front teeth. "I guess." "And how would you react if, when you looked under the bed, you found a monster there? What would you do?" I waited. The silence stretched between us. This was somewhere she hadn't been before. I don't know. But you'd do something. You wouldn't just sit there.
No,
she agreed. I'd run, hide, scream, maybe. I'm sure you would. And what would your parents do if they heard you scream?
They'd come running.
And they would. Any parent would. I let her think about this for a moment. Anna, you're intelligent, resourceful, and brave. And the other Anna, she is exactly the same. She is, after all, you. She, you, would not take it lying down. Don't think I haven't noticed the hobby horse propped up against the toy chest, ready for action. And the roller skates on the landing. I wasn't sure how the roller skates would help. Perhaps she hoped the monster would trip up on them. She'd be upset if I told her their mother worthily tidied them up each night. And the skates, I diplomatically agreed. It's not much, perhaps, but you're doing the best you can. And so would the other Anna. No monster is going to get a free lunch in this house. She laughed, a lovely little laugh, made all the more charming by the rarity of its use. I pushed on. So it's not a foregone conclusion that the monster always wins. And if it does not,
then there are two Annas,
she interrupted. This wasn't quite where I'd been going. I wanted her to acknowledge that she wasn't responsible for what happened in the other universes. How could she be? But sometimes, usually in fact, you have to let your patient find their own path.
And then four, and then eight, and then...
she babbled on. A small chime rang out. Okay, Anna, I think we've made good progress. We'll leave it there for today. There was a muffled voice at the door. Anna, honey, who are you talking to in there? Anna called back.
No one, Mummy.
Which was an illuminating denial. I jotted it down on my pad for future discussion, curious to see if Anna's mother would come into the bedroom.
Okay, sweetie,
she caved in, as I suspected she would. But go to sleep now. You hear? Anna waited until the footsteps faded away down the hallway.
Good night, Doctor.
Good night, Anna, I replied. Sleep tight. And then I slid myself back under her bed, listening to her breathing softly slow, and waiting for tomorrow night, when she would once again lift the covers and, all being well, discover me lying there, ready for our next session.
Liam Logan, fantastic stuff. Great. I liked that. The twist, always good. I remember once when I was a child, I woke up in the middle of the night, and for reasons that have not replicated themselves before or since, I decided I was going to sleep the rest of the night under my bed. My parents came in the next morning, and obviously I hadn't made them aware of this, and they freaked the heck out for a good half hour until I just kind of, you know, emerged and was like, hi, that was fun for everyone, wasn't it? That was just interesting to listen to as much as anything. I didn't do that, I was like five. Lovely stuff. Thanks, Liam. The story is by... the fabulous Michael O'Neill, and the reader is Claire.
Hello, my name is Harriet, and I'm telling you about some events that occurred in my old apartment. This was last December when I was living in Hounslow. It was as cheap as Greater London allows for people on minimum wage, and it wasn't covered from head to toe in mould, so I was happy. And I had Julian, my boyfriend. He and I had been going out for a few months, and we were definitely an active physical stage in our relationship. He'd taken me out for some celebratory cocktails because of, you know, obviously the new housing situation, and I decided to bring him back for some brand spanking new flat action, where I guess the plan was to consummate the drinks, so to speak. So right as we were, you know, there was a very loud noise that came from next door. Now, there are only a few rhythms or volumes or noises that can make you stop having sex, and I guarantee you this was one of them. It sounded like there was a tornado trying to get through the wall. No knocking, no pleading for quiet. It's not a neighbor. It was like a giant washing machine was pressed up against the wall. So we stopped, startled as you would be, and it carried on for a few more seconds, and then nothing. We tried again that night, and then the same thing happened. I can't do it, but it was loud. After that, we kept going to his place, and occasionally we would come back to mine if enough time had passed or we'd forgotten about the noise. Thinking about it now, the worst thing wasn't that it was fading in and out, it was either on or off, if that makes sense. But this wasn't just a noise, this was a force. And we knocked once or twice, hoping to, I don't know, sort out this grievance or apologise, but nobody answered. Once, I rang the landlord, and he said, "Floor's empty, there's no one in there." And I said, "There is someone doing something very loud in there, and I don't know what it is, and it's freaking me out." And he said, "It was probably Seven doing some drilling," which is the apartment above four, which I kind of just accepted because I thought that made sense. It's easier to believe that we were victims of some unfortunate timing than to think that someone was actually taking offence to what we were doing. Julian hated the noise, and I mean hated. He said it put him on edge. And the problem was he would forget, and he would try and instigate. So either I would remind him we were at mine, or the noise would start. I found myself staring at the wall at night, only when I was alone. I was afraid of the noise, but just once I wanted to hear it another time. It was horrible to listen to, but if it had happened once or twice in the middle of the day or in the dead of night when I was there alone, I wouldn't have minded. At least I'd have known it was a coincidence, but it never did. That made it worse. And my birthday came round. We went away for the weekend, Paris. He's cheesy like that. We had so much fun, and we forgot all about it. And so when we went back and we dragged all of our luggage up to my place, we weren't even, you know, we were far too tired, but he just kissed me, and it started. And we both realized how much control this noise had over us, and I felt so helpless, and Julian was going absolutely ballistic. "I'm not taking this shit anymore." And he stormed out, slamming every door his way, and he started punching number four's door. "Come out, come the fuck out, you creep." And he started kicking it, and I phoned the landlord. I told him it was definitely coming from next door, and Julian was about to break the door down. He told me he was coming round, and we'll look together. So I tried my best to calm Julian, but I was pretty angry myself. And when the landlord finally arrived, we opened the door, and this cold, empty breeze hit us on the way in. And we all knew that second that the place was empty, but we went in. And room by room, we looked at the bare carpets, the empty bedrooms. And when you turned the lights on, you could see the dust falling through the air. And then we got to the room that was through the wall. And there was a table in the center with an open Bible. And in big black pen, there was a circle around the sentence that said, "For God will judge the sexually immoral and adulterous." And the wall had a circle, like it had been sanded down through the paint, through the brick, and it went so deep towards the centre. It was like it had been mapped out by a protractor. I mean, it was perfect. It was a perfect circle. Julian walked up with his hand outstretched and vaguely touched the middle, and there was a loud bang as he touched it, and some plaster collapsed onto my bed. It was so close to my room that the wall had collapsed through. And Julian started saying, you know, he wanted to know who had the keys, who'd lived there before, but I just wanted to leave. I handed in the month's notice and I spent the rest of the time at Julian's. I only went back during the day, never alone, just to pick up my stuff. I had to cover the hole because, well, you know. Anyway, I live quite a way away from there now. And I never tried to find out what it was. I don't want to know. But I can remember everything about the room. I remember the Bible, the page, the sentence, the shade of the marker, the smell, the dust, the circle. And worst of all, I will never forget the noise. And no matter where I sleep, I still sometimes stare at the wall.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Claire. Fabulous stuff. Yeah, renting's hard. renting is difficult, and I have now lived in precisely two properties where on either on or about the time I'm going to move out, the washing machine's died. Coincidence? There was another time when the shower tried to kill me, so I think there's a narrative there, but I've not yet worked out exactly where I fit into it. So we'll go straight on to our next terrific act for you. one that I like to call Drag Me to Hell Gurney.
Hi, everyone. Sorry, I'm just going to adjust this for like short person dimensions. So I'm going to be reading you an extract from my big project, which is a poetry and storytelling show called Red Hoods and Glass Slippers, and it's taking fairy tales and putting them together in unexpected ways. So who here is familiar with the story of Snow White? Just like put up your hand or make a sound. Cool. So this is a question I would like to put to you all. If you were in the woods and you found a dead teenage girl, would your first response be to kiss her? Yeah, see, when you think about it like that, it's kind of creepy. But I would like you to imagine that you are the sort of person who would do that. And that you are, let's say, a prince. You are very rich. You are used to doing whatever you want. You are feeling a bit frustrated because you've spent the past couple of weeks looking for this girl who left a glass slipper outside your palace and you can't find her anywhere. And then, when you gave up on that search, another maiden caught your eye, this time not just her feet encased in glass, but all her form. Her red and white and black, stark as berries on a dark snow-bearing branch, her body just as cold. And how you yearned to kiss those lips, warm them with your breath. Who knows what she remembers? A simple, silent girl, she lost your fire when she woke, began to speak. The next, you caught and married. No woman is enough for you for long. They catch your eye by blazing bright, these decorated things of air and light, but each new beauty cannot shrink your appetite, and how, like butterflies, their brightness pulls and fades. And you remember butterflies that flit so bold and bonny, how your questing childhood hand would reach for them, catch them, crush them in your fist, unknowing till too late how this would break their frail magnificence. And you remember butterflies pinned down, encased in glass, in cabinets in your father's study, the jewels of their wings arranged so neat as if to form a sheet of crowns. And you remember Snow White, Her perfect stillness, her doll-like face unmarred by time, her glass coffin in the light, and you remember butterflies and smile. Your first wife lasted less than a day. A winter wedding, your mountain castle wrapped in woods and snow, mistletoe hung from every beam. All flushed with wine, a game proposed, hide and seek. But when she hid, none could find her, though you searched until the dawn. Perhaps she ran away, you think, and something in your heart chimes relief. But she is not gone. Months later, in the dryness of an attic, a heavy-lidded chest, and her. Her skin is like the roses still bound in her bouquet, fragile, papery, dead. She is shrinking into herself, and as you lift her body, the silks and gauzes of her wedding gown trailing beneath, you notice just how light she is. You'd wanted a bride far more than a wife, and now your wish is granted. She is yours, forever and unchanging. For a second, you consider, call the servants, the guards, deck the battlements with black drapes of mourning, but no. This exquisite thing is yours, the air between you, private and unstirred. Snow White is to you long gone, but better you have this, a beauty that remains unwoken by your kiss. And this is how it starts, your library of girls for perusing at your leisure. The next one's easy. No family to mourn her, this country girl you pluck from the fields at first ripening. She spits diamonds each time she speaks. Her jealous sister chokes up toads. Her mother stews in bitterness. You put them both to death for cruelty to your bride-to-be. Whisk her away in secret. In your commissioned portrait, her smile all but outshines the pile of diamonds in her hand. Her perfect happiness has come at last. And now, beside that portrait, her suspended corpse, embalmed and painted with a youthful blush, but no disguising for the bruises on her neck, the tight red welt across the throat, her lips all chapped and raw. And in an open box, diamonds with the blood dried on, her last screams that glittered scarlet, wet. And on stretch forth these rooms, each woman and the relics of her life, the dresses, portraits, gloves and fans, the jewelry, all arranged so perfectly, museum-like, the record of your passing, idling years. Your most recent catch proved troublesome. You'd gone in secret to a kingdom far away, left Prince Reynard behind, and took the name of Mr. Fox, ex-soldier, down at heel. 12 shut-in sisters who each night danced their shoes to rags, discover their secrets and win a wife or fail, be put to death. So was the edict of their stately father, king of this foreign land. They thought they'd tricked you, but no sleeping draught could match your poison strength. Invisible, a night cloak round your shoulders, you tracked them through the bowels of the castle and found, across a lake reflecting unknown constellations, an underworld of fairies, ghosts. You watched them dance until the dawn, reported it next day. You won again, and took your pick. The eldest would be best for you, a man on the edge of his 40th year, but no. The youngest, just 16, the one who pricked her ears and noticed something wrong that night you followed them, the one who danced the wildest and the longest, the one whose sullen glare across the hall the morning after lit in you some gruesome fire. You'd like a challenge, something you can break. And she, dear thing, had almost bested you, stole your ring of keys before your wedding night, gone searching through the twistings of your palace. Perhaps she thought to find her way back to that fairy carnival. Perhaps all she thought of was escape. She found the rooms, a grisly promenade, dried mistletoe and out-of-season roses. Those blood-stained diamonds, a golden ball, swan feathers, a cloak sewn out of nettles, a wishing ring, a rich embroidered carpet, and each one with a body. Some wrapped, some flayed, some waxy and preserved. And in the seventh room, her own dancing shoes, all tattered hide and ribbon pounded thin. The door clicked shut behind her, and there you stood, murmured, be bold, but not too bold. And the fight she gives you is not enough to save her or to sate you. Her youth and wildness, sharp and sour, has made you crave the bittersweet tang of knowledge, experience. And so you find Rapunzel, and she finds your seventh room, where worn-out dancing shoes line up like soldiers' boots. The girl hangs awkwardly, her neck askew, her bruises livid, broken arm, dead eyes open. In her portrait, they're blue like deepest water, and she is not overjoyed like other brides. Her face is pensive, dark, intense. Her two pairs of eyes each seem to plead, cut me down, end this. And so Rapunzel will. Thank you.
El Gurney, fantastic. Thank you very much. Seasonal, if nothing else. No, brilliant, brilliant. I got the entire Grimm's fairy stories not all that long ago, and I actually highly recommend reading them because they are problematic, and there is a body count, and they are so basically the ones that you know are weird. The ones that you don't know are the ones that are too for anyone to tell you. They were the ones that Disney looked at and went, no, she turns into a goose and then she dies, and that's the first quarter of the story. So we're going to proceed with the rest of the evening, and I've forgotten the name of the person who's coming next. Is it Ian Green? Yes, got it right. Ian Green, ladies and gentlemen.
All right, I'm just going to read you an extract, actually. So this is from my story, The Ossuary Tract, which is published in Scare Mongrel, which is a collection of horror stories out by The Pigeonhole, a small press company. So I hope you enjoy. Anyway. "Do you smell bone dust?" the woman asks eagerly. And the old man immediately stops, pulling open his door. He holds it half open and squints. In the dim light of the hallway, he appraises the stranger. "It's a hell of an opening line," he says. And then he waits, and he stares. After a moment, she steps forward and he steps back, and then she's at the threshold and she smiles, a smile full of thick teeth. "Please," she says, I have evidence. Your essay." The old man is entirely still. He stopped breathing. And on the edge of the door, his knuckles are pale as his grip tightens. "My essay," and he sighs and opens the door and lets her in. He doesn't recognize her as one of his students. She must have found a copy in the common room. As they walk to his living room, she doesn't stop talking. He's barely listening, but she lists all the usual things. I read it last night and it was incredible. I've never read about extraplanar emotional predation. How did you find me?" Normally, he hears these rants in his office, in the refectory. He's unsettled by her appearance at his home. "The Ossuary Tract, the bone book, how did you decide on that name? I have so many questions." I understand, but what are you doing here? How did you find out where I live?" The scent of the catacombs." He holds up a finger to silence her, and then runs that hand over the back of an armchair, his fingers lingering on the worn upholstery. He looks around the room at the bookshelves and inhales deeply through his nose. All he can smell are the flowers on the table and the remnants of his lunch in the kitchen. Is there something else? The scent of bone dust? If there is, he can't tell. He turns to her and speaks. "Os Karkarias, look, the essay was designed to make you think about the possibilities of evolution in an endless universe. It was designed to make the reader think about the energy of emotion, something as simple as a story can elicit. It's a hypothetical, it's an exercise of the mind. Predators and parasites that live in stories, creatures that feed on emotion. It's an exercise. I'm flattered you've tracked me down and I'm glad you enjoyed my essay, but It was an exercise to entertain my students, and nothing more. He expects her to look deflated, but she doesn't. So he gestures for her to sit and doesn't offer her a drink. As she straightens her coat, he notes the skin on her hands and face. It's dry and cracked. Psoriasis, maybe? She looks ill in a vague, undefined way. Too thin. She sits on the edge of her seat expectantly, her joints cracking as she does, and he sits back in his armchair defeated, simultaneously sighing and running a hand through his thinning hair. What do you want to know about the ossuary tract? She shakes her head. He looks confused. She smiles and runs a hand through her drab hair, then pulls a thin book from her satchel. I found one, she says, coy. I found a bone book. I wanted you to see. She hands him the book, more of a pamphlet, really. Collected Stories by J.L. North. The old man would sigh again, but he feels it's becoming repetitive. It was a game, he says. It's not real. She looks at him and raises one eyebrow and then looks around the empty room ostentatiously, scanning for anyone who might be taken in by this lie. They sit in silence for a long time. What flavour is it then, your ossuary tract? Despair? Happiness? Lust? If you've read the essay, you know the theory. Each parasite or predator is particular to one emotion, like a hummingbird with a beak that only fits one flower. The girl grins her toothy grin again, wider than ever. Melancholy, she says. The old man furrows his brow and flips to the first story as pigeons fuss up a windowsill outside. Wool and Snow by J.L. North. It is late afternoon.
Ian Green, thank you very much. Brilliant stuff. And, okay, moving straight on to the next one. MJ Starling.
Evening. This one's kind of a confession and kind of a warning. So around the beginning of autumn this year, I went on two dates with a nice chap who worked behind the coffee counter in Rough Trade, which is a music shop off Brick Lane. I go in there sometimes on a weekend morning to do a bit of writing, and over a little while, he got to know my usual order, and I got to know his name. And one Saturday, I happened to be getting up to leave around the same time as his shift was finishing, and I thought, he knows how to make a good coffee. He's got good taste in music. He doesn't have a beard. What's the opposite of three strikes? So I took the plunge and I asked if I could take him out to lunch. Given where we met, obviously we mostly talked about music. Given where he worked, obviously he knew a heck of a lot more about it than me. And on date number two, he came armed with a mixtape. Now, in hindsight, I think the second date is probably a little bit early to be throwing out a mixtape. And in even hinder sight, if that's a thing, I think maybe any time after you've graduated compulsory education is probably too late to be throwing out mixtapes, especially the literal cassette tape kind. They're undergoing a sort of a resurrection. There's a rack of them in Rough Trade nowadays. But without hindsight at the time, I was a little bit charmed and a little bit, quite a lot flattered. Because here's a chap who's known me, who's sort of met me a handful of times, and he's put effort into taking that small amount of evidence and trying to work out what sort of thing I might enjoy. And so instead of thinking, what is this weird second date business, I'm thinking, I did the asking, but this guy must have been really into me. So I accepted his mixtape, and I went home, and because I know a lot of theatre people, and you never know when someone's going to do a period piece and put out a call on Facebook for all your retro rubbish as props, I still own a Sony cassette Walkman. And so I took the tape out of the case and I put it in the Walkman and I put the headphones on and I listened and I listened and I listened and I listened. Because that's what you do when you bring new music home, right? You listen to it on loop to the exclusion of all other sound until you know every lyric by heart and every beat and every note and every breath and every little beat. No? Just me? So a week goes by and two things happen. And the first thing is that I start hearing things. Whispers. They start in silence, along with the ringing in my ears, like that high-pitched tinnitus whine is sort of a bright fishing wire that dredges these things up from somewhere deep. And they're meaningless syllables from a language I don't speak or have never heard, or they could be code or they could be cipher, but they're always low and always even, always calm. And I deal with this by shutting out all silence, headphones on, mixtape on loop. And the second thing that happens is the guy ghosts. He misses our planned third date, and everyone at Rough Trade says that he's quit, but nobody knows why or where he's gone or how to reach him. And so now I'm in a weird limbo sort of situation, because we knew each other just well enough that it's weird that he's disappeared without saying anything, but nowhere near well enough that I can make inquiries without coming off kind of desperate and kind of hurt. And how do I deal with this? Again, headphones on, mixtape on loop, as if there might be a clue there somewhere between the notes. And on the 267th, 268th full playthrough, about halfway through side B, I notice there is something there between the notes. Whispers, low and even, the same ones. And I hit stop, and the whispers stop. And I hit play, and there they are again, muted, crushed down by the music, but still there in between the notes, in between the tracks. And I hit stop, and I wait. And in comes the ringing in my ears, and with it comes the whispers. And I ease the play button down halfway, dragging the tape over the heads at half speed. And with the weird, distorted half-speed music come weird, distorted half-speed whispers. And in that moment, I've solved half the mystery, because I used to make cassette mixtapes when they were a thing. I used the same tapes over and over again, recycling them as my music taste changed. And I know that if you've got a cheap tape recorder, it never truly erases anything. The tracks that were on there before are always still there, very quiet, muted, but you can still hear them between the tracks you've recorded over them, between the notes, between the breaths. And so now my question is, what are these whispers? How did they get there? What are they saying? Whose voice is it? His? If it's his, was he trying to hide them? Was he trying to get rid of them? Or did he know he was giving me this? And so now I've got two choices. I can go after this guy. I can hunt him down so that I can wave this mixtape in his face and say, what is this and why have I got it? Or I can forget he ever existed, say, good riddance, bullet dodged, never know anything more. Here's what I do. I take the mixtape out of the tape player, put it back in the case, put the case in my pocket. That Saturday, I head out to the music flea market at the Electric Ballroom. I go right to the back of the room where there are stalls that still sell tapes. And I crouch down and I go through the long cardboard boxes of cassette tapes. And when I'm absolutely sure that none of the stall holders are looking, I take the tape out of my pocket and I reverse shoplift it into that box. Because what I want to do is snap the thing in half, to disembowel it, to yank all the tape off the spools. But there's a little voice in my head, the voice that will probably save my life if I'm ever in a kind of cabin in the woods kind of situation, that says whatever's in here, maybe best to leave it in here. And that's why this story is sort of a confession and sort of a warning. And I don't know what it means, but I can tell you what I took from it, which is that when a format dies, it's probably for a good reason, and you should probably let it stay dead.
Awesome. Thank you, MJ Starling. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome back. Welcome to those who have joined us. We have two more people tonight, and the first of them is Mr. Darren Lee.
So he says, well, I'm trying to find the story. So the Dead Pages is the nickname of the obituary section of the newspaper. It's just referred to as the newspaper in the story. And they are located in the basement of the newspaper's offices. And they are rushed off their feet because basically the world is kind of ending. And there is a strange virus / condition that is going around called the attrition. And that means that people are kind of dropping dead It's confounding science. No one really knows what is happening. And this has been going on sort of for months, and people are trying to get on with their lives. But the offshoot of this is that because the legions of dead are also including famous people and people who've done notable things with their lives, the obituary section has now basically taken over the newspaper. And they are the writers, extra writers have been hired, and they are now living in the basement. No one goes outside for fear that they might catch something, and all of their kind of needs are taken care of. And so basically they just work their asses off during the day, writing about the lives of all the people that have died. And then at night they have kind of a little dormitory where everyone sleeps, and they all kind of take pills out like a light, and then they wake up the next day and work their asses off again. And it goes pretty much like this every single day without any kind of break at all. So this is the extract I'm going to read. Is from the middle of the story, and the obituary editor, Christopher Chaplin, has heard from one of his writers called Felicity, or Fliss, that there is something untoward going on in the night. And so he's decided to stay awake and find out what that is. Chaplin skipped his pills and stayed awake. Not that he ever needed the dose. He was perpetually shattered, and the task that he had given himself of fighting sleep for the night was already sapping the last dregs of his strength. The others grunted and slouched in their bunks, good and obedient pill takers, just as instructed. Chaplin had no idea how long he needed to stay awake. It was the first time in months that he had experienced the luxury of inactivity. His unrestrained thoughts had been clouded with Fliss's final days in the office. Something nagged away about her night visitor. He felt it was worth checking, if only to cross off some of the uncomfortable theories that he had started to foment. You are stupid, he thought, trying to beat the night. And for what? A glimpse of something you know doesn't exist? His hand was starting to waver when he heard a distant rattling in the corridor outside. It sounded like a trolley being slowly pushed, its contents tinkling as it trundled past. It was probably one of the many night workers who magically tidied the basement each night, the ones who slept the floors, and delivered all of the writer's requested perks. Chaplin swung himself out of his bunk. He thought he saw Graves stir out of the corner of his eye, but the sports writer was dreaming in a drug-induced haze. Fighting fatigue with tired, aching muscles, Chaplin made his way to the door that led into the corridor, making sure that the rattle was ebbing away into the distance. Satisfied, he crouched down and eased the door open, quickly looking both ways. Pressing himself hard against the wall, Chaplin edged his way towards the main work area. As he neared the corner that led to his desk, he saw the trolley. He broke cover to get a closer look. He shuffled, creeping desk by desk, hidden in the basement's partial darkness and shadow. His new location provided the best vantage point. The trolley was pulled to a halt at his own desk. He could just about make out the figure of an orderly from behind. The orderly leaned over the desk. Chaplin heard a soft thud as a package was dropped into his drawer. His routine delivery of nicotine patches. They would be needed. The man moved on to the vending machines, pulling a key out of his pocket to open the frontage. But as he did this, Chaplin caught a fleeting glimpse reflected in the glass. The image was unmistakable. The orderly's face was pebble smooth, and utterly featureless, as if a flesh The image was unmistakable. The orderly's face was pebble smooth and utterly featureless, as if a flesh-coloured gauze had been stretched over someone's head, obscuring anything approaching an identifiable human feature. Chaplin gasped involuntarily before ducking down behind a desk. He was desperate to see more. The orderly began to head in the direction of the service elevator. It was off the limits to employees, so Chaplin used to take the stairs down into the basement every day. But how long had it been since he'd even used those? He remembered they led towards the building's reception, but he had been living in voluntary confinement in the basement for so long that the rest of the details had faded from his mind, as if a shabby grey curtain had been pulled in front of them. The orderly bundled the trolley into the elevator and used a key to send it up to another floor. Chaplin searched again for a longer glimpse of the figure's face to confirm that the vision was not the product of a fevered imagination. As if reading his mind, the orderly obliged and began to walk further down the corridor. It was enough. Chaplin began to cower once more, but he relaxed when the orderly approached a door and left the corridor. The door was a post-attrition arrival. He'd always assumed that he had been dug out, led to some kind of storage space. He quickly jogged down the corridor in pursuit. He stood before the closed door, grasped its handle, turning it slowly so as not to make a noise. He pulled the door towards him, and his heart struggled in his chest. But when he appeared around it, there was nothing, just bricks and mortar, as if the doorframe had been put there as a practical joke. Chaplin slumped, gathering his breath, and the adrenaline in his body ebbed away, enacting a tug of war with his exhaustion. Emotions rioted within him. He told himself that he was losing his sanity. He fought to regain his composure as he leant against the coldness of the wall. Once his breath returned, he was filled with the inescapable craving for a cigarette, a proper cigarette, not just a surrogate absorbed into his skin. He needed the coarse rush from sucking on smoke. He can imagine one between his fingers, the pleasurable yet guilty sensation of stepping outside and raising the smouldering coffin nail to his lips. There were a couple left in his desk from the old days, kept there to test the mettle of his willpower, but now they were readily available so that he could anchor himself in reality before the morning. He shuffled back to his desk, keeping low to the ground, the expectation of heading outside, of feeling the cold air on his face before the hot, thick smoke was building. He found one in a squashed pack from months before. The feeling of holding it was instantly smoothing. Chaplin walked back down the corridor at a brisk pace. The desire for nicotine carried him up the steps and straight into another brick wall, exactly where he used to access the upper floors. He stood, confounded by the masonry. They had been sealed off from the outside world. Chaplin shivered. Had the attrition really been so bad that the editor wanted the basement bricked up for the protection of the dead pages? Or what if the wall had been erected to stop anyone from the dead pages escaping? The notion flickered in Chaplin's brain, barely crystallised, and he felt a pinprick to his jugular. He span around, and in the last seconds of consciousness, he saw the faceless orderly standing over him with a syringe. Chaplin overslept. He was late for the day's work. He slowly roused himself, his consciousness fighting the last clouds of sleep. It had been another nightmare, he concluded. The legions of ungrateful dead had been replaced with faceless men, that was all. Still groggy, he slowly dressed and checked his pocket to find something long and papery. Small flakes were loose in the lining. It was a flattened, torn cigarette.
It's time for our last storyteller of the evening. She's sensationally here at a late stage. It's Kate Darby, ladies and gentlemen.
That's who we mean. Hello, it's Katie, but don't worry, it's fine. It's okay, don't worry. This is a story, in fact, the second story written specially for this slam, because I sent the first one to Liam and he's like, yeah, it's not very scary, is it? I don't know if you read the description. So this is my attempt at scaring. And he also suggested that I use my prop. So, which for those of you listening on the radio, is a pregnancy bump. So here it is. See what you think. Knock, knock. By me. You might not think it to look at me now, but actually, I've always been very careful. Over-cautious, even. My friends at uni used to call me Churchill after the insurance dog, because I was always calculating risks, thinking about the worst-case scenario. I always carry an umbrella, toothbrush, and phone charger. I submit my tax return weeks before the deadline. I've never missed a train or a plane, got lost, or lost control. And I'd certainly never let a strange man in a bar buy me drinks, let alone go home with him. God forbid, let him drive me after he'd been drinking all night. Until one night, about 9 months ago, I did. I don't remember much about him. My whirlwind romance, as I call him, because it sounds better than one night stand and a whole lot better than absent father. He was handsome. I know that. Because the head of every woman in the place, and some of the men, turned as he walked in. But the details are hazy. He might have been tall or short, blue-eyed or brown, dark or blonde. I can't even remember, I know this sounds odd, if he was black or white or Asian or Eskimo. When I try to think back, I just have a blank. I suppose I'll find out soon enough. Just in time for Christmas. When I realised I was pregnant, I was horrified, to be honest. Ow. Oh, sorry. I know I shouldn't say that, but it's true. Apart from the whole sex with a stranger followed by a drunk drive lift, I wasn't careless, by the way. Not only did I make him use a condom, I was tipsy, not completely pissed. I also had a coil and I was on the pill. But somehow, my mystery man super sperm still got through. As soon as I missed my period, I went straight out and took three tests, one after another, lining them up on the sink, each with two bright pink lines. I couldn't be pregnant, but I definitely, positively, was. Oh, I was in denial for a while. I was a modern, professional woman in control of her biological destiny. Besides, I'd been so careful. Surely this couldn't happen to me. But then the morning sickness kicked in, and I had to face up to the truth. I did consider other options. Of course I did. Oh, stop it. But I couldn't go through with it. Every time I even thought about it, I suddenly felt very afraid, as if my own life were on the line. A blind, inexplicable panic would knock me sideways. I'd have to drop the leaflet or close the laptop and lie down till the terror went away. I'm starting to shake just thinking about it now. So I left it too late, and now there's no going back. Ow. Ooh, big one. Sometimes I think it's got a weapon in there. When people ask me about it, I don't really know what to say. It has the right number of limbs, and the heart beats, and the parts move, but when they did the scan, they couldn't tell the sex, which is why it's still an it, and they couldn't really see the face. Usually they give you a little sonogram of the fetus sucking its thumb or floating peacefully in its amniotic bath to take home and stick on the fridge. But not with this one. Sometimes they're just shy, smiled the scan technician as she dug the gel-covered wand into my bump for a better picture. On screen, the little creature inside me visibly wriggled away, thrashing angrily, then curling up, face hidden. There, she cried as she checked the sex. I think it's a... Oh, no. No, that's the tailbone. Bit longer than usual, that's all. Sorry, looks like baby's not going to open its legs today. I felt the first kick around 5 months. That's pretty normal. But I've asked around, and what isn't is how regular it is. As clockwork, day and night, it's like someone knocking on a door to be let in, or
out, I suppose. Kick, kick, kick. Pause. Kick, kick, kick. Drove me mad for the first few weeks, like Chinese water torture. Constant, monotonous kicking at every hour. It never seems to stop. It makes me think of sharks, how they have to keep moving to stay alive. I barely notice it now, except when it's a really big one. Oh! Like that. I used to talk to it sometimes, because, well, I haven't really got anyone else. Plus, they say you should, to bond with the baby. I was making a sandwich one evening, after leaving work, late again. Cheese or salami? I asked my bump. One kick for cheese, two for salami, kick. Kick. I thought it was just coincidence. Till I tried again. Tea or coffee? Tea. Toast or scone? Scone. Just a silly game, till it wasn't. The last thing I asked it before I went to sleep was, are you really talking to me? Two kicks for yes, one for no. Kick. Kick. I sat up in bed. I was sweating all over. What do you want? I asked. My mouth was dry. I could hear my heart beating in my chest, and below it, behind it, another throbbing, fast, faint, but strong, the pulse of a stranger's blood. What do you want? I said again. And for the first time in months, silence. Since that night, I haven't talked to my baby. I try not to say too much around it, to be honest. Not when I know it's listening. I probably shouldn't be... Ow! I probably shouldn't be talking to you about this now, to be honest. But I had to tell someone. Just to see how mad it sounds out loud. Just in case anyone can help. I thought if it seemed too crazy, I could just pretend it was a story. So, let's say it's a story. Not long to go now, at least, till I find out how it ends.
Katie Darby, Katie Darby. And, I mean, I've had a fantastic evening, to be honest. Have you had fun?
Yes.
Way. Fantastic. I don't feel the need to go through a method of like who has won and who has not. That may be the point of a slam. But thank you everyone, and I hope this will not be the last of them, because I've enjoyed it immensely, and I look forward to seeing you again at another one very soon. Thank you very much. Good night.